From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. From Steve Bannon's departure to President Trump's announcement last night about the war in Afghanistan, the White House continues to be driving the national news, for better or worse, from a Republican perspective, and things are heating back up in Sacramento. The state legislature is back in session, and California's GOP assembly leader survived a coup attempt by fellow Republicans, at least for now. We'll hear why Republicans are so angry with him. Politics from Sacramento to D.C. That's our topic this hour, and we'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, last night, President Trump announced plans to send additional troops to Afghanistan, acknowledging it was a reversal of his position during the campaign.
My original instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States.
Or as you might say, who knew war was so complicated? Breitbart News, by the way, under Steve Bannon's control once again, slammed the president's decision. While here in California, there are calls to remove the GOP leader in the assembly because he voted for a cap-and-trade bill pushed by Democrats and Governor Jerry Brown. We're talking politics this hour. Let me tell you who's here with me. Callum Borchers is politics and media reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us from Washington this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
And also joining us by phone from D.C., John Fassman. He's Washington correspondent for The Economist. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Scott.
And with me here in the studio is Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Marisa.
Hey, Scott.
So let's begin with that Afghanistan speech last night, Callum. As he said, he came into office criticizing all foreign involvements, really, saying we can't be the world's policeman. He had called for a speedy withdrawal for Afghanistan. So what do we know about how he came to this decision? How tough a decision was it for him?
Well, our reporting today indicates that this was essentially a decision that came down to getting the advice from the generals on his staff and kind of deferring to their better judgment, which is sort of a remarkable shift if you think about it. We're talking about a man who on the campaign trail said that I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me. And that was part of his whole shtick during the campaign, of course, was knowing better than people who actually know better. And that was part of his appeal. He's sort of a counterintuitive thinker. And specifically, as far as staying out of foreign entanglements, that was one of the big draws for Breitbart News and its base. And I wrote yesterday that this Afghanistan speech would be kind of the first test of the post-White House relationship between Trump and Steve Bannon. But I was not prepared for the level of fury in Breitbart News coverage this morning. I mean, they are really walloping him for what he said yesterday.
Well, and they did say, I think, right after, I think it was the day that Friday when Bannon left, they said this is war, right? I mean, so in some ways they telegraphed that this was not going to be soft coverage of the president.
Well, they did, accept that the way Bannon phrased it to the Weekly Standard and to Bloomberg as he left and did those exit interviews was that he was going to war for Trump against the establishment, which I took to mean that Breitbart and its coverage would essentially lay the blame for any decisions that Trump makes that Breitbart does not like at the feet of the quote-unquote globalists on the White House staff. And yet that's not what we saw today. We saw very tough coverage of the president specifically. They weren't giving him a pass, and they weren't buying this spin about kind of evolving in office. You played that remark about the president saying, you know, it's the calculus is a little bit different when you've got more information when you're commander-in-chief. One of their stories today said, no, that's not what's going on. This is about the swamp getting to Donald Trump. Another piece said it was a first-person account from a Breitbart writer saying, you know, I voted for Donald Trump because I wanted change. I may have made a mistake. I mean, that is really a dramatic reversal from a site that really cheered him to victory.
Marisa?
But, I mean, is this any surprise in a lot of ways? This is, you know, the exact sort of, I think, cleave between folks on the sort of far right and traditional Republicans who, in large part, are sort of praising what he's doing this morning. This sort of anti-interventionist, America First policy is really sort of that populist message. And I think that, you know, it seems to me if you sort of look at the last week and what happened with Charlottesville and then even the beginning of the speech where he talked a lot about patriotism and how, you know, everybody is serving who, of many colors. And I think tried to sort of insert that message into this speech, it seems like this is what he and the administration have really been gearing up for, sort of, I think, knowing that this was going to be the reaction from some of his base.
And John Fassman, do you think that this is sort of a combination of Bannon's exit and John Kelly, the chief of staff, the general, reasserting his control over the message?
Well, I take him at his word when he says that things look differently from behind the desk at the White House. I think he figured out what his two predecessors did, which is that leaving would create an unacceptable and dangerous vacuum. What struck me about this strategy is that the extent to which it drew in Pakistan and India, and called on Pakistan to rein in its support for terror groups, and called on India to step up and do more. Now, he didn't really say how he was going to get either of those two countries to join us, and it just seems to me that this would be a really good time if you're going to execute an incredibly complex diplomatic strategy to have a functioning, fully staffed State Department.
Right. And in fact, I think there were reports earlier that he still hasn't named an ambassador to South Korea, for example. That's a separate topic. But you're right. There's clearly, and some of that, of course, is intentional. Rex Tillerson supporting cuts in staffing at the State Department. But you do see that you know, these positions do and can matter. What impact, you know, Marisa, might this have generally on those countries, for example? I mean, how much authority does a president have to, you know, tell Pakistan or India what to do? I mean, this is not the first president who has asked them to step up, for example, in the fight against terrorism.
I mean, I think that really depends on Donald Trump and how far he wants to go in terms of putting conditions on funding and, you know, sort of alliances that we have with these nations. I mean, I do think it's interesting, you know, he had that line and to the point about cutting the State Department, you know, we're killing terrorists, we're not nation building. And if you talk to most people who have worked in sort of the diplomatic and foreign affairs world, they'll say those things are inextricably linked. You know, what are we going to leave in Afghanistan if all we're doing is killing terrorists but not sort of leaving behind a functioning government? And so I think that, you know, to the point of him saying it looks different from back here, what if he is really devolving power to generals, if that's the whole point of the strategy, which is what he said Obama didn't do, that he sort of controlled things from D.C., how much are they going to turn back to him in the coming months and say, we need help on the ground sort of building this country back up? So, again, I think, you know, it is fascinating to see this rhetoric and how it really is being embraced by the sort of Republicans who, you know, are the traditional power structures. But will he follow through, and what happens when things get tough and this drags on?
And Calum Borchers, you do see sort of a circling of the wagons of people like Lindsey Graham, folks who had been very critical of Trump on things like Charlottesville, saying that he's really turned the corner here. He made a strong statement about Charlottesville. He's gotten the message right. Is this, do you think, a turning point in terms of his relations with Republicans on the Hill, or just too soon to say?
Well, everything feels backwards today, doesn't it,
right,
Scott? I mean, you know, you had, even before Trump delivered his speech last night, you had Marco Rubio, who, of course, was a fierce rival during the Republican primary, defending Trump and attacking his critics, using the same argument that Trump himself made in the speech, which was to say, you know, now the president has reevaluated his position based on having more information in office. That's essentially a good thing, and that, you know, it's unfair for commentators to accuse him of hypocrisy. Now that he's straightening it out. And then, as we mentioned earlier, you see the reverse of that from folks that were previously the president's biggest fans, whether it's Steve Bannon in Breitbart News or Ann Coulter, Mike Cernovich. I mean, these are folks who have been staunchly in Trump's camp. I think what we're seeing is that, you know, it's too soon to draw large conclusions. I think what we're seeing is sort of a case-by-case basis. And in some cases, it's kind of predictable, right? So you mentioned the Charlottesville example. You know, that's a case where the Breitbarts of the world will defend Trump viciously against his critics. So the president can essentially say any inflammatory thing he wants, and that is part of his appeal to a certain segment of the electorate. And so Breitbart, Coulter, Cernovich, Sean Hannity, those folks are going to stick up for him in those cases. The things that they actually care about aren't those tonal things. It's certain policy matters. And one of those things is staying out of foreign conflicts. And then, of course, for the Lindsey Grahams and Marco Rubios of the world, it's the exact opposite.
John Fassman, we have seen sort of, I would think, unusually strained relations between the president, the White House, and the military over the last several months. The Joint Chiefs of Staff and each of the heads of the different branches of the military really pushed back on the president's change in transgender policy. They also pushed back on what he said on Charlottesville in terms of diversity and hate speech and white supremacy, all that stuff. And then, of course, you had Steve Bannon trying to undermine General McMaster of the NSA. Is there a trust deficit, do you think, between the president and the military, or is that not really such a big problem? And how might it play out, or how did it play out in this decision that he announced yesterday?
I think there certainly is a trust deficit between the president and the military. I think if you look at the transgender ban, there is a way of enacting policy across the military, and that way is by through a thorough review process and through the Defense Department and through the ordinary channels. He tried to enact policy by tweet, and that just doesn't work. And as for the post-Charlottesville comments, I mean, the military lined up with business leaders also. And so what you saw is them sort of acting out of a sense of what is right and wrong, and feeling they had to make a statement. I mean, I don't know. It would probably not be right to say that trust deficit will be erased by his current Afghanistan policy, but he clearly did show that he listens to the generals who were in his employ, that he listens to General Mattis, General McMaster, and General Kelly, and that his shoot-from-a-hip instinct seems to have some limits.
That's John Fassman, Washington correspondent for The Economist, talking with him and Callum Borchers from The Washington Post this morning, along with our own Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And we are talking about not just Afghanistan, but all the news out of Washington in the past few days and in Sacramento as well. Marisa, I stepped on you. What did you want to say?
I totally agree. I just wonder if this holds. Like, I think with Trump, it's really easy to say, oh, he gave, a decent speech and he said what he was on the script. But what happens again in a week or 2 weeks if things change on the ground in Afghanistan or his opinions of these generals change? Does he tweet out something? So I think that even if this went some way to papering over some of his differences with Republicans in the military, that could change on a dime.
Well, and that's a good place to pivot, I think, Callum Borcher, is because the president is going to Arizona today. He's giving a political rally in Phoenix. The mayor there and others in Arizona had urged him not to come. There's talk that he may actually pardon Joe Arpaio, the very controversial sheriff, former sheriff of Maricopa County. What are your thoughts about, because that's a situation where he might very well be off script again and throwing gasoline on the fires that have, consumed his presidency in the first few months.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was just about to bring up that Arizona rally tonight, and I think that we've seen this pattern over and over again. It is actually one of the president's great skills that served him well on the campaign trail, which is that he caters his message to the audience before him, right? And so I would expect that we will see a different Donald Trump tonight than we saw last night. I mean, he was really sort of married to that teleprompter last night. He didn't deviate very much at all, was not ad-libbing, and that, of course, is exactly what he does when he gets before an audience. He likes to feed off the crowd, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if the message we hear tonight is different, not only in tone, but also in substance. And we've seen that, flip-flops in a matter of days on immigration. We've seen it on abortion. We saw it just recently last week on Charlottesville, right, where he came out on the Saturday and blamed many sides for what happened. And then on Monday, he sort of walked back those remarks and condemned white supremacists individually. And then on Tuesday, he was back to blaming both sides in a news conference. I mean, we really can't draw a conclusion about what the president thinks about Afghanistan based only on last night. I think we have to wait and see what he says tonight, too.
And Marisa, of course, this is a president who campaigned and, in fact, announced his candidacy with a shot at illegal immigration and a lack of control at the borders. So in a way, tonight he's in his element again.
Yeah, and I think it will be interesting not just to see what Donald Trump does and what happens inside that rally, but of course outside. There are multiple counter-protests planned. You know, this is why the mayor asked him not to come. It's interesting the Republican governor of Arizona is, I think, trying to have it both ways a little bit by meeting him on the tarmac but not attending the rally. He's up for re-election next year. So, you know, I think that how strong that rhetoric is, how much he digs back into that, one of his sort of, you know, rally the base issues around immigration. And then the Arpaio question, will he do that there? You know, did the sort of backlash against that make him dig in on that, you know, pondering, or will it push him to, you know, away from it?
And John Fassman, Arizona is a fraught state right now. We had John McCain, the senior senator, casting the deciding vote against repealing the Affordable Care Act. You've got Jeff Flake, who has become a leading critic, the other Republican senator from Arizona. He is now facing a primary challenge, most likely funded by supporters of Donald Trump. So he's walking into a very volatile political situation tonight, isn't he?
He is, and this is where he shines, for better or worse, volatile political situations. This is the beginning of his involvement in the 2018 primary season. We're going to see him step in, I believe, for Kelly Ward. In Arizona, Jeff Flake is a staunch conservative, but has been very critical of the president. And, you know, as we know, the president can tolerate disagreement, but he can't tolerate personal disloyalty or personal criticism. We're also going to see this dynamic playing out in Alabama, where supporters of Donald Trump helped Roy Moore, the Supreme Court justice, to a surprise primary victory, and where Mitch McConnell and the Senate Conservatives Fund are backing Luther Strange. Now, what's interesting about that is that we are also going to see Breitbart, I believe, backing Roy Moore and against Luther Strange. So this will be another proxy battle between Donald Trump and Steve Bannon.
And, Callum Borchers, where does this leave Republicans in Congress in terms of, you know, the last thing they want to see is the president of their own party attacking a member of the Senate of their party? How does this play out in that regard politically, do you think?
It's difficult to gauge because there hasn't been sort of a prolonged enough stretch, I think, of total frustration and total satisfaction, right? So I think that for a lot of Republicans in Congress, the justification for getting behind Donald Trump in November, albeit reluctantly, was the thought that, well, at least it will be better than having a Democrat in the Oval Office, right? We understand that he is going to do and say certain things that we object to, but we'll have a better shot at passing our legislative agenda with him there. And I think you've seen that encapsulated very well in the last couple of weeks, where they've obviously been extremely frustrated with his response to Charlottesville. And yet, folks like Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio were heartened by what they heard last night when he talked about his plan going forward for Afghanistan. I think right now, those good moments like last night are enough for many Republicans in Congress to stay with him at least at arm's length. They are not ready to disavow him entirely.
And Marisa, like it or not, their fates are linked, right? I mean, as goes the president and his popularity, so goes reelection chances for Republicans next year.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because, you know, as we've watched, I think, you know, Trump's base really stay with him largely given every twist and turn and scandal of the last 8 months. You know, Congress on the whole is still very unpopular. So I think it depends, obviously, on the district and the individual member. But clearly they, I mean, have an eye out to what he's doing. And I mean, it's so unprecedented at the national or local or state level to have the leader of a party essentially go after its own incumbents. I mean, and we've seen this repeatedly, right, with not just someone like Lindsey Graham or John McCain, who's been very outspoken, Jeff Flake, obviously, who, you know, in a lot of ways held his fire until this book came out recently. And so I just think it's I mean, if you're at the RNC, you must be sort of scratching your head going, how do we deal with this? And how do we, yeah, walk this line between protecting our own and not sort of publicly disavowing the president?
And John Fassman, we haven't talked about Russia. And yet that investigation by Robert Mueller still very much alive and, you know, picking up steam. I suppose it's good. And the president's quite pleased that it's been knocked off the front page.
I think that's undergirding everything. The Russia investigation is still grinding forward. He's assembled a crack team. I would like to say one other thing, one other point to make about Republicans and their embrace or, tepid embrace of Trump. One thing we saw over the past week when members of the business council resigned en masse is we saw a difference in how politicians and business people assess risk. I think if you are the head of a firm, especially a big, you know, consumer-facing company, and even more especially a company like Under Armour, which wants to reach out to young and non-white consumers, you really can't afford to be seen standing next to someone who can't quite make up his mind whether Nazis are fine people or not. You really have to distance yourself immediately because that shows up in your bottom line. The issue for Republicans is if you are a conservative representative or senator and your voters from a conservative state or district, your voters are still Trump's voters. So the risk still, I think, for most of these, most mainstream Republicans is whatever they may think of his comments about Charlottesville, the risk is still greater in disavowal than in staying with him. And until that risk tips, we may see some isolated bits of rhetorical disapproval, but we're not going to see a whole-scale revolt.
And turning to California, Marisa, there's a little bit of a schism here in the California Republican Party as well. The leader of the Assembly, Chad Mays, yesterday faced a vote of no confidence, which he survived. His opponents needed 13 votes to get rid of him as Assembly leader. They only got 10. He's going to live at least till next Tuesday, a week from today, when there's going to be an election for leader. But tell us a little bit about, you know, how did it get to that point? And what does it say about the state of the Republican Party in California today?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that we're sort of in the exact opposite situation in California as in D.C., right? Democrats have every statewide office, 2/3 majority in both houses of the legislature. And yeah, Chad Mays is kind of on the ropes, at least with the party faithful outside the Capitol, since he made this pivotal vote for Jerry Brown's cap and trade deal. This is to sort of extend these pollution credits. And it's really
brought six Assembly members with him, Republicans.
Right. And it's a big piece of the sort of overall strategy by Democrats to meet these pollution reduction goals in the coming decades. And I mean, it's interesting. What Mays will say is, like, I did this because, A, you know, even Republicans are in favor of curbing greenhouse gas emissions. And in California, there's not really this debate over climate change happening. It seems like most people agree with that. And on the other side, and he says that he got concessions, you know, that he got some leverage out of this deal. And it's worth noting that the business community and some of the most quote unquote conservative business organizations were on board.
Farm Bureau.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think one of the things that hurts him is that two Democrats sat this out who are in moderate districts. And so Republicans who are angry over what they see as basically a tax vote have that to lean back on.
Gave them cover, basically, to
avoid. Yeah, but it's interesting. You know, I mean, it does feel in a little way like they're kind of eating their young. And I mean, is that the best way to go when you don't have any power, really?
All right, we're going to leave it there, but come back right after the break, and we'd love you to join us, 866-733-6786. We're talking politics this hour on Forum. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org or tweet at us. We're @KQED Forum, or leave a message on our Facebook page. No excuses for not leaving us a message. You got plenty of options. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And we continue our discussion about President Trump, Afghanistan, and everything political going on in D.C. and here in California as well. Joining us this hour, Callum Borchers, politics and media reporter for The Washington Post, Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, and John Fassman, Washington correspondent for The Economist. If you'd like to join us this morning, give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Going into the break, Marisa, we were talking about the problems within the Republican Party here in California. Yesterday, the head of the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Kevin De Leon, announced there would be a series of hearings next month in California on some of the rise of the violent extremism that's happening in California. What are the politics of that?
You know, I mean, it's an easy one for Democrats in the legislature to harp on, although, interestingly, Kevin De Leon didn't actually mention President Trump's remarks. And I do wonder if part of that is sort of laying the groundwork to get some bipartisan support for these hearings, because we have seen some sort of backlash from at least one Republican over a caucus statement last week. Mark Stone left the Jewish caucus after a pretty harsh statement criticizing President Trump, which surprised me, honestly. I think you can support the president and still be sort of I don't even know what the word is, but it was pretty shocking what happened, what he said last week. But yeah, so we're looking at a series of hearings, one to really assess the rise of white supremacy. Southern Poverty Law Center says we have the most hate groups in California of any other state. Of course, we're huge. So
we have the most of everything.
The other one is looking at if there are laws needed to help control violent outbreaks at public rallies. Interestingly, Nancy Skinner, a Democrat from Berkeley, did already introduce a piece of legislation around this, basically trying to expand hate crime statutes to include someone standing up, quote unquote, to racism or bigotry as a protected class. She says the victim in Charlottesville, Heather Hayes, that the driver of that car cannot be prosecuted for a hate crime, which, you know, on its face sounds like, okay, fine, but I do think it raises some interesting questions.
How do you decide what they're, you know, what they're, how they're being targeted and what they stand for?
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. Very subjective. It seems like the kind of thing Jerry Brown might not be too supportive.
Yeah, we'll see what it looks like. I mean, you know, this is just the beginning, so I think that debate will be fascinating to watch.
And also, Callum Borchers, some of the Democratic members of the Senate Homeland Security Committee yesterday calling for hearings there. On some of the rise of the extremism. That, of course, is a very partisan issue on their part. Is there any, you know, stomach on the part of Republicans in D.C. to look more closely at this? I know that California Assemblyman Daryl Issa called for similar hearings in the House. Of course, he's in a very tight race. He's perhaps the most vulnerable Republican in the House, having just barely gotten reelected last year. But, you know, is this an issue that Republicans would pretty much like to just move on from in D.C.?
No, I think that the short answer to your first question is yes, there might be some appetite among Republicans, but I think that they would want to see a pretty comprehensive and wide-ranging definition of what you would look at as hate groups, right? So you've heard a lot of conservatives pushing back against, you know, the characterization of Black Lives Matter or Antifa as sort of the noble side in this battle that we saw in Charlottesville. You know, they are saying that, hold on a second, those white nationalists are terrible people, but there is, as the president said, two sides to the story. And so I think that that is what you would want to see from some of the Republicans. I'm reminded in a way of the Russia probe, right, where Republicans have said, OK, we're going to expend some of the resources of our congressional committees to investigate Russian meddling in our election. But as part of that, we also are going to take our cues from the president and put a lot of our focus on the leaks and the unmasking, right? So they have their own angle on it, I would say.
All right, let's go to the phones now. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Tim, up in Roseville, you're first.
Good morning. I had a couple ideas or thoughts that I would like your guests to address. One is the idea that one of the guests referred to the Republicans as eating their own young. And while I'm no Trump supporter, and it's hard to see any pattern to his logic, if there is any, is that they are supporting what their people, they feel their people will do, and trying to get those people as opposed to just a Republican into office. And then my second comment is, where's the Tea Party in all this? I haven't heard the Tea Party phrase mentioned in months.
All right, Tim. Good thoughts. And in fact, Marisa, there was a big Tea Party convention in Fresno a couple of weekends ago where they very much stood up for Donald Trump and drew the line. You're either with us, meaning the president, or you're against us. So that, you know, the Tea Party, although not as active right now, not as energized as, say, the left in California, still very much here.
It is, but I think that comparatively, again, to nationally, I mean, the Tea Party was not quite the same force here as you saw in a lot of other places several years ago. And I do think that, you know, what you're seeing with someone like Chad Mays and the pushback you're getting from the outside is a difference between people who are sitting, you know, within government and trying to sort of find ways that they can still be effective and relevant, and party activists who, you know, the same as on the left, you know, want some litmus tests. It might be abortion for Democrats, it's taxes for Republicans. And so the question, I think, is if you look at the demographics of California, if you look at who's registered to vote and how much market share Republicans have lost really to independent voters, even more than Democrats, how do they, you know, sort of keep their base but bring in folks who maybe are turned off by some of that, you know, the fighting with it between the parties, and also this idea that things, you know, that you're so rigid that you can't compromise. I mean, if you talk to a lot of independent voters, what they say is they want the parties to work together. And so, you know,
And even many Republicans say that.
Absolutely. I mean, in theory, right? Until devil's always in the details. So, you know, it is a question for the party. And of course, the party leadership has every right to take this vote of no confidence and to try to push Mays out. But I think that, you know, if your concern is winning elections, that there is a balance to strike in this very blue state.
All right. Let's look at some listener comments here. The U.S. military should learn from the humiliating defeat of the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1970s. One listener writes, the region is very difficult to occupy, a fact well known since Alexander the Great's invasion of Afghanistan. No more U.S. military involvement. It only leads to more instabilities, death to young Americans, and death to innocent Afghanistan civilians. John Fassman, the president did not lay out details or what winning looks like, what the exit strategy is. Is that just the nature of this particular war? I mean, as somebody pointed out, one of the generals, I think, how long have we been in South Korea? It's been a very long time. Is that what we're facing in Afghanistan?
I mean, that would be great if we were facing South Korea, which is a stable, you know, first world country. I think Afghanistan, you're right, he did not lay out a sort of what victory looks like. He said we're going to be killing terrorists. Killing terrorists is not a strategy. Killing enemies is not a strategy. It is a means to an end. It is a part of a strategy. And so I think the problem is he discovered, again, what George W. Bush and Barack Obama discovered. They found that it's very difficult to sort of see a way out of Afghanistan with honor that doesn't leave a vacuum. And you have to at some point decide to be in or out. And in his case, he decided to be in, as he put it, against his instincts and against what his base wanted.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Again, it's 866-733-6786. And Bruce in Danville, you're next.
I watched the speech last night, and I was just shocked. I thought it's not him. He's just reading off script, and this is just a ploy to get us to stop focusing on Charlottesville and the American Nazi problem and things like that, which I think are the real priority right now. The biggest threat to America right now is American Nazis and white supremacists. Going after Afghanistan with the same policy that's been tried before and calling it a different thing by calling them losers and us winners is not going to achieve anything, and basically it's just a ploy. The real problem with American foreign policy is that we keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, which is we look for a tyrant or a dictator, and we hope that this time we can control him and that he'll be our tyrant and he'll do what we want. And then eventually they have inevitably let us down, and then we're back to square one again. And so this is the same thing over and over again. And it's basically the Vietnam strategy being played out over and over and over. We've never played out the only successful strategy we've ever had, which is the World War II strategy, in which we directly occupied and directly administered every day of life of the German and the Japanese population after we beat them. And the first thing you have to do is beat them, and then you have to occupy them. And we're not willing to do that. So
John
Fassman, going back to this Vietnam strategy, and it just keeps exploding in our face.
Yeah,
literally.
Bruce, thanks for the comments. John Fassman, to what extent did you hear the president's speech last night as being a departure from what the Obama administration had been doing, in either in tone or in substance?
Well, in tone, it was certainly a departure because the speech was largely, as most of his speeches are, was largely about Trump and what he did and how he reached this decision. In substance, it's not a departure at all. He is going to send more troops to Afghanistan, just like George Bush and just like Barack Obama did. Now, I don't think that either the American people or certainly he wants to send another 10,000 troops. We're not going to do a resurge. But, you know, we've got about 8,400 troops there now. We're sending another 4,000. That's a significant boost. He ran, as you say, to get us out of Afghanistan. And so to see him reverse course like this so dramatically, it really puts him in line with his two predecessors in a way that I don't think anybody expected him to be.
And, Marisa, did you want to jump in? Okay, let's go back to the phones. And this time it's Colin in San Francisco. Colin, welcome.
Morning. I'd have to agree that this represents a continuation of Obama's policy with respect to sending more troops to Afghanistan, and I would have to wonder whether some of Mr. Trump's more rational supporters might regard this as a betrayal. Is there an opportunity here for the Democrats to essentially run against what has become a war of choice. How many failed states in this world do we have to invade and occupy? There's not just Afghanistan. There's Yemen, Somalia, Venezuela. The list goes on and on.
Well, Marisa, you know, in some ways, Afghanistan is sort of the forgotten war. I mean, and part of that is the fact that we don't have a draft. The war is being fought by a very small number of people in terms of who's affected, unlike, say, the Vietnam War, which was alluded to a moment ago. And one thing that's interesting is you're seeing Democrats recruiting candidates to run for Congress who are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. So it may become more a part of the conversation on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and I do think that that's, you know, certainly a smart political strategy for Democrats. It'll be interesting to see sort of how Democrats in Congress react to what the president is doing, which, again, is sort of tweaking around the edges, but not fundamentally changing the strategy. But I do want to go back to this idea that, you know, what Trump said is that things look different from where he's sitting. And, you know, combine that with sort of his harsh rhetoric against ISIS and terrorists and this idea of protecting America. I mean, that seems to be the argument he's making, that leaving Afghanistan, you know, and leaving a vacuum for terrorism doesn't work. But how that plays out without a diplomatic solution is an open question.
All right, Colin, thanks for the call. We're going to go now to Phoenix. We mentioned that President Trump is going to be heading to Arizona later today for a big political rally, a very controversial rally in Phoenix. And joining us now is Carrie Young. She's a reporter at KJZZ, the NPR member station in Phoenix. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us, if you would, what's happening, what's the mood, what are the concerns in Phoenix today as the president prepares to hold that rally?
Well, the mood, I guess it depends on which side you're on, but it seems to be a little bit tense here, at least for some pro-immigration groups. They are holding a rally, or the first rally of the day, against the speech tonight. That's starting at 10 a.m. this morning. There are more scheduled for this afternoon, you know, but people are equally excited for the president to arrive here. From what I've heard, there are people already lining up at the Coliseum to get inside the doors. They don't open until 4, and the rally itself doesn't start until 7. So,
and the mayor, of course, has asked the president to postpone this. What are the concerns? Is it just that there's going to be a Charlottesville-style sort of face-off between supporters and opponents?
I think that's part of the concern. I think the biggest concern is that President Trump might pardon former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. I think the mayor is concerned that if he chooses this timing in particular to do that, that that would just be really divisive. And that kind of energy might actually, from what I'm seeing or from what I'm guessing, he's thinking that that might actually incite some violence.
And, of course, the sheriff is, former sheriff is now awaiting sentencing, I believe, right? He was convicted of racial profiling.
Yes, he was convicted of criminal contempt of court, and he is awaiting a sentencing date. I believe that's in October.
Arizona, as we said earlier before you joined us, has become sort of a boiling pot of politics. You've got John McCain, of course, who was at crossways with the president on a number of issues. You've got Jeff Flake, who is up for re-election next year, facing a likely Republican primary challenge. What's the scuttlebutt there within the Republican Party, but more generally, what's the political temperature statewide there now?
The political temperature, you know, we've seen a variety of things, really. Our governor has not confirmed if he will or will not be at the rally tonight. He is a prominent Republican, but he's, again, not confirming if he will be there. We do have the challenger to Senator Jeff Flake's seat, Kelly Ward. She, I believe, will be there tonight. She was also pointed out by President Trump on Twitter. He, in a sense, promoted her campaign, which is a little unusual, given that Senator Flake is the sitting senator. You know, we have Senator McCain, who has gone both ways, both for and against Trump, I guess specifically some of the things he said recently. So it really can go both ways here in Arizona. It's been interesting to watch.
And in terms of the rally tonight, what kind of police presence and preparation is being made by the city?
Well, they've been pretty tight-lipped on the specifics, but they said they will be fully staffed and they're working with county, state, local, city, and even federal partners on this. From what I've been told, the National Guard is on standby, though apparently that is pretty normal for any large-scale event, whether it's the Final Four or even a presidential visit. So they seem pretty confident that if anything starts to break out, they'll be able to contain any kind of situation pretty quickly.
All right. Carrie Young, a reporter with KJZZ, the NPR member station in Phoenix. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Calum Borchers, you know, one of the things that surprises me, and, you know, you think of the President of the United States as the person who tries during times of crises to unify the country. And we saw from the very first speech Donald Trump gave as president, his inaugural address, that he really that wasn't going to be part of his MO as president. And tonight, to a certain extent, you're seeing once again he's going right at the middle of the divide that we have in this country. Is that something that you think is going to work for him?
Well, he is, and yet it comes on the heels of last night's speech, which sort of aggravated a lot of people in his base as well. So I think what you have right now is kind of a real inconsistency in the president's strategy. You know, we've seen in the past where he runs into criticism in politics and he becomes more insular, right? He sort of turns inward and goes back to rallying his base. And yet that's not exactly what we're seeing right now. And to me, it's sort of symptomatic of a White House that is lacking a clear communications strategy, right? I mean, keep in mind that they don't have a full-time communications director right now since Anthony Scaramucci was ousted at the end of last month. Now, Hope Hicks, who is one of his longest-serving communications aides, is filling the job on an interim basis. But as we've seen over and over, the president doesn't really empower whoever is in that role, whether it's Scaramucci, Spicer on an interim basis, Mike Dubke, Jason Miller before Inauguration Day. These are all people who have not lasted very long in that role, partly because the president thinks he knows best and really prefers to be his own messenger and his own spokesman. And so right now, there's really no coherent messaging strategy.
And Marisa, here in California, of course, we're anticipating two rallies that are organized this weekend, one at Chrissy Field here in San Francisco, and then one on Sunday in Berkeley, both sort of right-wing, alt-right, white supremacists, whatever you want to call them, groups that have been organizing these events. There's a chance the National Park Service may pull that permit. We're going to find that out, I think, in the next couple of days. But, you know, what are your thoughts? I mean, this is, a very potentially volatile situation here.
Yeah, I mean, I think in both situations, there's a lot of questions and onus on the local authorities as to how they're going to handle this. Chrissy Field is federal land. It's National Park Service. But of course, it's surrounded by San Francisco. And there's been a lot of questions about open carry laws, for example, and what people are allowed to do in a city and state that has such strict gun laws, even though there are some sort of loopholes around federal land. In Berkeley, they don't need a permit. The mayor has asked them not to come. We did see very violent scuffles and basically riots, melees break out at a similar rally in the spring there. And so I think that local officials are really bracing and planning for the worst in a lot of ways. But, you know, these are, I think it is important to mention, slightly different groups. The one at Chrissy Field is actually a right-wing militia. They say they are going to have people of color speaking. It is not supposed to be a white supremacist rally. But of course, you know, who you attract to these things are not always up to the organizers. And I think on the left here, it's been interesting to see this sort of conversation occurring among progressives about how best to respond. Do you show up? There's people raising money, sort of using this as a pledge, you know, for every quote unquote Nazi that shows up, we're going to give money to the Southern Poverty Law Center. There's a counter dance that is planned not far from Chrissy Field. So I think the hope is that this won't turn violent, but I think everybody is sort of planning for, you know, the fact that you really don't know how these things are going to go.
Got some listener comments here. Rick writes, Trump is the president because there is a huge revulsion with our government and the many mistakes it's made over the last three decades, out of control spending, open borders, and hyper regulation. Time to clean out the swamp before we lose what made this great this country great. Although John Fassman, you know, I think it was last week when he left the White House, Steve Bannon said that the Trump presidency we fought for is over, including this whole notion of draining the swamp, which really never got going, I think most people would say, based on who he appointed to his cabinet. But what are your thoughts about that in terms of this transition with Bannon gone now and how the emphasis, may change?
Well, it turns out that the swamp contains a lot of people who are pretty good at their jobs, and you need to run a functional government. And so I think part of the Bannonism is really good, and Steve Bannon is very, very good at throwing fire on his enemies. And Breitbart is going to be really good at making life miserable for establishment members of the Republican Party. Can it do much beyond that? I'm not really sure. I think that was the problem, that it's much easier to be in opposition than it is to be in government.
Here's a tweet from Chris who says, appalling, oldest trick in the presidential playbook, an impotent, scandal-ridden administration announces a war and reaps praise, wag the dog, you might say. Carl tweets, much ado about everything. The people who lament Trump are playing his game, decide what should be, and go make it happen. Playing his game can't win. And then William writes, when the generals see Trump, do you think they notice his 5 draft deferments? He had no skin in the game. Does that turn their stomachs first? Let's go back to the phones now. Again, the number, if you want to join us, 866-733-6786. And we go back to the East Bay in Dublin. Yama, welcome.
Yes, hi. I'm an Afghan. I've been here since 1983. And following up to Trump's speech, we're optimistic that this new plan can work out, just because I think he just has a different style and a different strategy. So sending troops like the past presidents doesn't mean we're going to end up with the same results. It's a different strategy and means of how we do it. So us as Afghans, we're optimistic that something good can come out of this.
And when you say, you know, the community is optimistic, what makes you say that? Where are you hearing that
from? Just us hearing from my friends, you know, after hearing Trump's speech, we were happy to hear that. We can't just leave the country, you know, in disarray after you've invested so much time and money in it, right? It's like about the last 10% now. We have to try to, you know, it's the hardest last 10%, but we have to go all the way now. And hopefully, I think he'll hold more people accountable and try to get into the corruption and the Pakistan ties with the Taliban and all that. I think he's going to uncover and really hit some uncovered territory and be more aggressive. I think Obama and the other presidents were a little bit more passive and relaxed and more lenient with the government. You know, we need to hold them accountable, even the Afghan government.
John Fassman, do you think there's how much credence is there that, you know, we can finally, we're really going to get serious about corruption? I mean, that has been a huge issue, not just in Afghanistan, but in Iraq as well. And you might argue many other countries around the world that we support. Are the president's words much harder to put into practice, do you think, than just giving a speech? I think that's sort of a rhetorical question. But what are the barriers there?
Much, much, much harder to put into practice. I mean, weeding out corruption is a difficult, multi-step process that requires not just the will of an outside force to do it, but it requires the will of the people themselves to change. I mean, you have to, it's the hardest thing in the world to not hold out your hand when it's your turn to take a bribe, but that's what you have to do to end corruption. Presidents, you know, ending corruption has been, it sounds good, but it's very hard to put into practice. As for the broader question of whether we're going to see something different through the strategy, I mean, it's not a different strategy. It's the same strategy wrapped in a different package. So we should expect the same result.
Kellen Borchers, you know, it strikes me a lot of times after a president gives a speech in the past now, past presidents, they go out the next day and then they hit the trail to, you know, sort of rally the country around the speech. That does not seem to be happening today. You've got the president going to Arizona. Perhaps you'll mention Afghanistan, but that's not necessarily the best place to do it, given all the other things happening in Arizona that we've talked about.
I think that's right. Although what I would say is that I'll be very curious to see how President Trump follows up last night's performance, which, as we noted before, was pretty well received, at least by establishment Republicans. Recall that in February, when he delivered his first address in prime time as well to a joint session of Congress, he got pretty positive reviews all around for that performance. And then he very quickly trampled on it by tweeting that baseless allegation that President Obama had tapped his phone at Trump Tower, right? I mean, this is a classic Trump problem where he sort of tramples on his own good headlines. I'll be watching to see whether he learns from that experience this time, whether he follows up on last night's speech with a relatively tame, good week to kind of get the most out of it, or whether he reverts to form.
And, of course, part of that is who's in charge, and is he going to be speaking off the teleprompter, or, you know, will he be talking, as he often does at these rallies, just in an impromptu kind of way?
Well, that's right, because as I mentioned earlier, he's kind of his own speechwriter in chief. And tonight, my expectation is that he will be largely off prompter, speaking off the cuff. And that's where we saw him in that epic news conference just a week ago, last Tuesday at Trump Tower. Keep in mind that he wasn't even expected to take questions at all last Tuesday. He was just going to issue a statement at Trump Tower, and all of his aides were taken by surprise and by all accounts dismayed that he took reporters' questions on Tuesday, seemingly because he just couldn't help himself. I think it's that impulsivity that comes back to him over and over.
Just a few seconds left, Marisa Lagos. I should mention that Vice President Mike Pence is coming to California next month to do some fundraisers with Kevin McCarthy. He'll be in Bakersfield, Los Angeles, Sacramento. That should be quite a spectacle, I would imagine.
It should. And again, on the point of speaking off the cuff, it'll be interesting how much he talks about Afghanistan. I think this is definitely something that Pence has been intimately involved with and has really been a spokesman for the administration in recent weeks.
All right. Marisa Lagos, KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks also to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, John Fastman, Washington correspondent for The Economist. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny, and we appreciate your listening, and more to come.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.